This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and so happy to be with you. I'm live from Orlando at this purenlp.com conference where we're learning all about neuro-linguistic programming. At the bottom of the hour, Scott Carter is going to be with us, the playwright and executive producer of Bill Maher's show, who is also here, and we're going to be talking about what he's learned. And then at 45, of course, we'll have Talk Media News. They'll come in and tell us what's going on in the world. And then at the top of the next hour, 1 hour from now, Dr. Richard Bandler himself, the inventor of NLP, is going to be with us. And he is willing to take calls, although we'll see if we have time. But you know, if you have questions or concerns or arguments or whatever, I think you'll find it fascinating. The other thing that I, you know, we've been talking about Brett Kavanaugh and the U.S. Supreme Court, and I've shared, I think, pretty much all of my opinions. Number one, he helped, he had clerked for Kennedy. John Roberts had clerked for Rehnquist. These are the two guys who went down to Florida to teach Bill, George W. Bush's team how to argue before the Supreme Court to get the U.S. Supreme Court to block the Florida Supreme Court's recount requirement, which handed the election to George Bush. And like I said, a year later, a month after 9/11, we found out that Al Gore actually got more votes in Florida than George W. Bush did. And the New York Times buried it in the 17th paragraph because Sulzberger said the country was in a crisis and he didn't want, you know, to freak out the country. So, you know, there's that. Plus, Kavanaugh has said that he doesn't think that sitting presidents should even be questioned in civil cases, much less criminal cases. You know, plus, he emphasized twice in his speech last night that he's Catholic, which I think was a whistle to say that he's all in favor of blowing up Roe v. Wade. So we've got that. The other thing that I found fascinating, you know, I've told you many times, one of my little tricks for getting to sleep, or the way that I get myself to sleep at night, is I listen to my BBC podcast, because there's something about droning British accents that puts me to sleep. I mean, I love British accents, but it just works for me. And so I'm laying in bed last night, and Louise was falling asleep next to me. She doesn't need to do this, but she can't. I play it real faintly, so she, you know, she's on the other side of the bed. She couldn't hear it. And 6 or 7 minutes into this BBC broadcast, I just sat straight up in bed, reached over, turned on the light, said, "Louise, wake up, you've got to hear this." And I played it for her. And I'm like, why is the BBC telling me this instead of CNN, MSNBC, and the New York Times? I pulled up my computer, I looked at the New York Times, I looked at the Washington Post, I didn't see it anywhere. And I'm going to play for you this little clip, just a little tiny piece of last night's BBC podcast, courtesy BBC. I'm going to play this for you and see if it's as shocking to you as it was to me. Here it is.
A BBC investigation has found more people who have accused President Trump of sexually inappropriate behaviour. The Panorama programme spoke to some of the guests at parties arranged by Donald Trump in the late 1980s and 90s. They say he hosted and attended gatherings where middle-aged men would prey on very young women. The White House hasn't responded to the allegations. Richard Bilton reports.
Panorama has spoken to men and women who were at Donald Trump's parties in New York and Florida. They say young women, some as young as 14 or 15, would be partying with middle-aged men. Our sources say there was cocaine and alcohol around. One, who attended several parties, says the older men were there to have sex with young models. Barbara Pilling was 17 when she was told by her modelling agency to go to one of Donald Trump's parties. She says the future president approached her.
He said, "How old are you?" And I said, 17. He goes, "Oh, great. So you're not too old, not too young. That's just great." It was just disgusting. I felt like I was in the presence of a shark getting ready to roll his eyes back in his head and bite me. You know, that's how I felt. It was just like, get the hell out of here.
Panorama saw no evidence that Donald Trump had sex with underage girls. More than 20 women in the States have already accused him of inappropriate behaviour. He has denied all the allegations and accused the women of lying.
So that's the report from the BBC. I heard that. I was like, wait a minute, why is the American press not reporting this, number one? And number two, this is the guy, as these kinds of stories who come out, who just decided he's going to put on the Supreme Court the guy who said that even in a civil case, like, say, a woman who was 17 and got propositioned by Donald Trump, or just harassed even, can no longer depose him. You've got Summer Zervos, I think her name is, you know, trying to depose Donald Trump. You know, of course, you know, Michael Avenatti's all over this thing with Stormy Daniels. There's all these other women who are coming forward. This is going to end up before the Supreme Court, and Donald Trump is hedging his bets, I guarantee you. So, anyhow, back to your calls. Peter in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. I think it's way off base for Kavanaugh to opine that the POTUS cannot be indicted or subject to responding to a subpoena, or, as Kavanaugh says, distracted by a criminal investigation. He's not above the law, and I don't believe it's in the Constitution that there's anything remotely suggesting this. And if the president should be incapacitated, and I say whether it's physical, whether it's mental, or legal, that's why we have a vice president.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Very, very well said. And if the president can't serve, you know, if he's in the middle of a really messy indictment, let's say the Mueller report comes out and it turns out that Donald Trump has been a Russian agent for 20 years, or that he cut a deal with the Chinese that if they'd put $1 billion into his hotel in Indonesia and give his daughter a couple $100 million worth of patents, and or trademarks rather, that in exchange for that he would do the ZTE thing and let spyware into all of our military systems and bases as well as all our civilians. You know, if something of that intensity is going on, you know, more than, you know, hey, he got a BJ, which is what they went after Bill Clinton for, or lied about getting a BJ. If something like that was happening, then all the vice president and the Speaker of the House have to do is simply declare the president is incapacitated by this investigation, and I, Mike Pence, you know, and of course it takes the cabinet to do it, and it has to be ratified, but it's all right there, you know, in the Constitution, and, you know, they can take over, and I'm assuming that's what you're talking about, Peter.
Yes, I think this notion that somehow the president can remove himself from the ongoing everyday legal process is just absolutely off the wall Looney Tunes. And this guy is going to be on the Supreme Court. Are you give me a break? Thanks.
I'm with you, and as I said, I think that's why. That and the fact that he clerked for Kennedy, and they were using this to, because Kennedy, I don't think, intended to retire this year. I think he was going to wait another year or two. And he's in good health, and, you know, he clearly loves his job. He'd already picked out his clerks for next year.
Yep.
Something changed his mind, and I think this is what it was, among other things. It might have had to do with his son and his work at Deutsche Bank, which, you know, was so supportive of Donald Trump. Who knows?
Yeah, the money from Deutsche Bank apparently was funneled through Russian oligarchs. In other words, the Kennedy son was...
No, Deutsche Bank directly loaned money to the Trump companies.
Yeah, yeah. But the money that they took in came from a Russian source.
I don't know the details on that.
That was why they were able to do it at all, because the Russian oligarchs backed that loan, which is a gigantic amount of money.
Yeah, I can't say, you know, absolutely yes or no. I really don't know, but I'm with you. It's a big deal. Thank you for the call, Dave in Washington D.C. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm in Washington State, Tacoma, Washington. I'm a candidate for the U.S. Senate.
Oh, Washington State. I'm sorry. That's okay.
Yes, sir. That's quite all right, Tom. You know, we're only human. I'd like to start my comment with there are no crimes that have statute of limitations against humanity. And I see that our administration, current administration, is moving perilously close to that edge right now. As far as a woman's
You mean
life,
none of the internationally recognized crimes against humanity, like genocide, for example, have a statute of limitations?
That's right. Ask the Israelis about the Nazi exterminations. So
sure.
The thing I'd like to get back to is with the Roe versus Wade issue coming up, and that means all rights that will be questioned as well. A woman's right is no greater than mine. Her body is her body. And if a woman has to suffer assault, which results in rape and or incest, or the help of the mother. It's the mother's choice, the woman's choice to make that decision. A hard choice. I mean, it is a hard choice. Yes. And it's not a choice that I want to be part of, but I will support. I have 3 daughters and 9 granddaughters. And so you can see where I stand on this issue. And I think that us moving into that is not a good thing. So we need to make sure that we protect those women's rights.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, as a man, I for a long time, I was saying, sort of tongue-in-cheek, because I just know it'll never happen, but men should not be allowed to even vote on this issue.
But there's so many other issues, Tom, that are facing us. And, you know, and I'm grateful for your program. A lot of people here in Washington State listen to you, and they really enjoy the commentary that you provide. And as a candidate, you know, I'm facing this an uphill battle as far as military-industrial complex, police state, rights, in environmental, healthcare. Those are all on my my page.
And these are huge issues, and Roe v. Wade is a big issue. Sure. But whether or not you know, the environment has rights itself, whether or not people have the right communities, towns. I mean, this is the work that Tom Lindsay is doing with CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF.org, a great organization worthy of your support. This is the work doing, is they're helping individual towns say to giant hog farm operations or giant waste incinerators or, you know, whatever it may be, no, we don't want you in our community. And the Republicans now, who are all in favor of states' rights, in quotes, and all that sort of thing, instead are saying, No. We're not, you know, you local communities can't make decisions. This is going to end up before the Supreme Court. Do we have the right to govern ourselves? I mean, there's all kinds, you know, and there's all kinds of these issues. And I guarantee you with all these right-wing Republican Federalist Society nominees on the court, they are always going to rule in favor of the corporations. They always have. And this is just... this is why we need to make sure that there's always a Democrat in the White House, and why it's so tragic that 6 out of the last 7 elections, the majority of the people voted for a Democrat.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of your calls after this. What do you think is going to happen with this election? How do you think Democrats should play this game, as it were, this debate? Oh, yeah, when I come back. Oh, we're back on the air for our non-com stations. My apologies. Joe in Cupertino, California. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Weather change quite different. My wife's in Florida. I've been talking to her on the phone. Apparently, it's pretty humid. You're over there with the neuro-linguistic programming thing, and my wife's over in Fort Myers at an elections training education. And, you know, we're talking about the vote. Right. We're talking about the corruption of the vote, but I think we got to look at the numbers. I mean, we certified the election in the 5th of July. In our area where I lived, and we had like a 40% turnout, which is pretty good, I guess, for a midterm election. But nationally, it's somewhat below that, 30 less in most cases. But when I saw recently posted that, you know, the election, the people that actually voted, which is what we count, not the number of eligible voters, but the actual voters that voted, that 25% voted for Hillary, 24% voted for Trump, and the rest wouldn't really come out to the polls. You know, it just was an absence of participation. And I've been advocating for participation for some time. I just think that, you know, rather than here we go again talking about abortion. We're talking about this every 4 years. We always talk about abortion or we talk about this, but nothing gets done. This is the GOP's plan to take the distraction from what the real issues of today are. And Bernie talks about this all the time. We have to have the right messaging, but we have to say that we stand for something. And right now we don't even have a candidate. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to sit here and get really enthused for the upcoming election when we're still fighting about what? Roe v. Wade? I mean, we are arguing about the same things that they argued about when Obama was president. We didn't vote for our Supreme Court nomination. So the way we're going to deal with it as adults is we're not going to let them have their vote. I think we would let this go. Let them vote, and then put them squarely on the shoulders of the Senate majority leader and say, look, this is what a functioning democracy is supposed to do. They're supposed to take the president's nomination, like it or not, forward it for an up or down vote and let the Congress decide, not hold it up because...
Well, and this is, but here's the problem that we, that, you know, putting this in a political context, the problem that we have is that you've got these three red state senators, Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, and Donnelly, I think was the third one. Do you remember his first name? Joe Donnelly, that's right. Well, Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, right.
So you've got these three red state senators who all voted for Gorsuch. Are they going to vote for Kavanaugh, or are they going to block the vote? And if they block the vote, is it even going to matter?
That's right. It's not going to matter. So we're just making ourselves, we're feeding into Trump's hands by fighting over something that we really
but
don't
maybe.
Have.
But maybe. I mean, then you've got Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, and if they're convinced that when Brett Kavanaugh last night touted his Catholicism, what he was actually doing was dog whistling that he's going to overturn Roe, then you got a possibility that, you know, if you could peel off even one of those two Republican women, then the three Democrats hold firm, which, you know, is also in question, then I think you've got the possibility of stopping this guy. But they'll, you know, I mean, Trump is only a year and a half into his term. He'll just get another right-wing crazy who's going to knock down Roe. I mean, I think that's the case with all 25 of them.
You're going to go into the election, though, looking like Trump's going to say, they didn't even give me my guy. I didn't get my second guy. And I think that's wrong.
There you go. Joe, I got a boogie, but thank you for the call. We'll be right back with more from Orlando live here at the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and taking your calls on, ideally, on what you think about these judges and what's going on with this. At the bottom of the hour, From the bottom of the hour until the end of the show, I'm going to back off some of this conversation. I mean, we'll probably continue to have it, but in some small ways. But I want to get into this whole thing of neurolinguistic programming and how change happens. I wrote a book about NLP and politics. It's called Cracking the Code. And I wrote a book about NLP and ADHD. It's called Healing ADD. And Dr. Richard Bandler wrote the foreword to that. He will be our guest at the top of the hour. Scott Carter will be with us in a few minutes. So, let's see, the judges. Luke in Silverdale, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Luke, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, that was quick. Well, thank you for what you do, for educating all of us. This is my first time calling in. A little bit nervous here.
Well, thank you.
Speaking just earlier about... Judge Roberts and Kavanaugh's involvement with the 2000 election. That was my first year that I was able to vote in an election, and I remember that complete process and debacle very well. What I'm seeing here in the future, I think it's obvious. America kind of has like a 20-year reciprocal, I would say, history. One could argue like, when Obama was in office, that was kind of like the resurgence of the 90s, kind of like the Bill Clinton years, if you will.
Mm. Sort or of even this the 60s, the LBJ years.
Trump coming
the war.
In, yeah, with this disruption of Trump coming into office, it feels like it's going to usher back the oddies, the George W. Bush days. Where we have just extreme corruption. We may not have physical, like, death wars, but I think what we're looking at here is more of a civil cultural war going on in our society.
Well, we're in extreme corruption right now, Luke. I mean, you know, you've got the head of the EPA who just resigned. I mean, putting in a secret phone booth in his office so he can have conversations with people that are clear violations of federal law. You've got lobbyists writing laws. You've got, I mean, and you got Ryan Zinke doing this stuff. You got Mick Mulvaney doing this stuff. You got Betsy DeVos doing this stuff. I mean, Luke, I'm sorry we're hitting the break here, but so I hope you made your main point first, because that's the important thing. When you call in, make your main point and then support it. And if that was, it was an excellent point. Luke, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back right after the bottom of the hour with Scott Carter. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back with our old friend Scott Carter right after this. Hi, Tom Hartman here with you, and so happy to be with you. And in this hotel room that we're broadcasting from here at the Sheraton Four Points in Orlando, where we're doing a seminar with Richard Bandler and John and Kathleen Lavalle on neurolinguistic programming, is Scott Carter, who is a friend of the show. He's been on the program before. Scott, in his day job, is working as the executive producer of The Bill Maher Show, and he's also a playwright who has a play that has played in how many cities now?
19.
19 cities around the country, and the name of the play is?
The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord, and people call it Discord.
Yeah, and it's brilliant, and you're working
Thank
on
you.
A new play, too.
Thank you. I've got a new play also. Yeah.
So what caused you to think, hey, I ought to go to Orlando, fly across the country, and learn about neurolinguistic programming from this guy that some people say is like a madman?
Madmen do not turn me off. Madmen test my own thoughts, and I often find myself seeking things that are outside of my comfort zone. And on Real Time, we do 35 new shows a year. So it means we have a break in the summer, and this year it's July, and then we have a break between around Thanksgiving to around Inauguration Day, January 20th, which is also Bill Maher's birthday. And so often I will take a leap into something I don't know about at all that's going to challenge my preconceptions about me, and then hopefully it will give me something of lasting value that I'm going to come back to the office with when we next resume taping or when I'm working on a new play. And it's going to give me some additional skills, both in my work and in my life.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, a lot of continual growing throughout our lives. I mean,
and all of these don't need to be successful for you to have felt good about doing it. Mm. So, for instance, when the Beatles went to India, John Lennon was turned off by the Maharishi eventually, and the song Sexy Sadie originally was going to be Maharishi, What Have You Done? You've Made a Fool of Everyone, and then he chickened out on the White Album and turned it into Sexy Sadie. But it was still a good thing to do. And he later, before he was shot and killed, said he thought that he had been too hard on the Maharishi. And of course, meditation has been something that's continued for George for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. And actually, Paul and Ringo still do it.
Well, let's talk about you.
Okay.
So you're here doing this workshop.
Yeah, and we should note that it's a 9-day workshop and we are midway through day 4, so I'm not quite halfway yet.
All right, so we've got about, I don't know, maybe 8 minutes here. What are you learning? What do you think?
I wouldn't even maybe use the word learning yet. What I'm being exposed to is a number of different ways to both perceive how people communicate and how corporations communicate with us, and sometimes the embedded language they use by which to get us to buy their product or do what they want or vote for them. So it's things that are coming from the outside world to me. And then what I'm also learning for my consideration are techniques by which I may communicate better with other people. So it's both those things. It's from me out and it's from the world in. And I find some of these things, particularly after a night's sleep, after listening to these things all day, I'll find some of them really sticking to me. Like there was one phrase, I think, from the first day of brain grammar, which is something I never thought about, and then wrote it down. And that's one of the things I thought about. Another thing that stuck with me is when people try to help other people who haven't necessarily expressed a desire to be helped. One of the phrases they use is, "Well, you're driving your ambulance again," and I am a veteran driver of an ambulance, and try to tell myself it's something that I should stop doing.
Yeah, great stuff. So, how would you describe NLP?
I would describe it as an attempt, and I'm saying attempt now because I'm not through all the way through this, but I would say it's an attempt to discover the infrastructure of how the mind works that we might better navigate our interactions with others to be communicating what we want and have a better chance of getting it, and also to be understanding more what people want from us.
Yeah. At least more than one person in the workshop has commented that Donald Trump, whether he's doing it consciously or unconsciously, and certainly many of the people around him, are using some of these techniques of persuasion. It's kind of the dark side of the force, I guess, but you know, persuasion is persuasion. I'm curious your thoughts on the Supreme Court nominee, on the current state of politics, and if you can tie that back into at least some of the things that you've learned here.
Well, there's a quote from The End of War and Peace where Tolstoy has Pierre, the character that's based on himself, say, at the end of the day, all great matters are very simple. And if bad men can work together to accomplish their ends, then good men must work together also. Mm. And one of the things that I've been aware of from you and from others is that there is a knowledge of these techniques that has been mastered by people on the political right for decades now. And one cannot, even if one disagrees with these people, one cannot deny their success in owning at this point. The White House, the Supreme Court, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and a lot of state houses.
The majority.
Majority of state houses, and also they have made great inroads into universities. And so if people with whom you disagree are using successful techniques that you are not aware of, doesn't that mean that you should become aware of them if you wish to fight them in the marketplace of ideas?
Well, this is why I wrote Cracking the Code back in 2008 for the 2000, you know, and just in time for the 2008 election. I wanted Democratic politicians, and I gave it to a bunch of them. I'm convinced nobody read it, or not nobody, but some, you know, and yeah, you know, you've read that book. In fact, I think you told me you liked it so much you started giving. You said you gave.
I have bought it for others.
You gave a copy to Sarah Silverman or something.
Yes, you know. Yes, and it's interesting. You. Say that because when I started producing Politically Incorrect before Real Time, and after about 2 years of having conservative politicians and conservative pundits and journalists, and then also having a lot of liberal celebrities and politicians on, I became aware, and this was in 1993. Bill and I started working the week that Bill Clinton was inaugurated for the first time, so it's January of 1993. And I became aware that people on the right were so much more willing to do the grunt work to advance their own cause. And one of the generalizations I had after a season or two was that liberals were more convinced that they were morally righteous and did not have to have their facts straight. So, for instance, in these days, and that was before Fox News, it was before the internet, before MSNBC, a lot of conservatives we had on were doing things like writing newsletters and sending out 2 pages or 4 pages
at a time. That's Richard Vigory's whole thing.
Richard Vigory, Paul Weyrath, Emmett Terrell, American Spectator, a lot of these. So they weren't looking at this to be something glamorous, or it wasn't even necessarily something that was bringing them a lot of money. It was, they were so committed to these ideas that they were willing to work day and night for them and train a lot of other people who were following in their footsteps. And now, of course, with the proliferation on the right of talk radio, of Fox News, and of all sorts of websites, there are many more ways for these people to get out that message. And I feel like there are people who I... And one more thing, which is after doing 25 years of shows with Bill, where we've had as many conservatives on the program as liberals, almost as much, maybe 40% conservative. A lot of them are my friends. A lot of them are people I really enjoy talking to afterwards, though I may not agree with them. And I appreciate when they can be, first of all, changing my mind. I really appreciate that. But also I appreciate when they've just challenged me to be strong about the ideas that I've had for a long time and maybe haven't dusted off the supporting ideas by which I've held these ideas. Mm-hmm. And so I've come to have this begrudging admiration, but I also think it's like when I was in high school, I was a debater. Well, to be in debate, you had to learn rhetoric, you had to learn logic, you had to be willing to do work in evidence. And if the team you were opposing did a better job than you did, they would win the debate and you would lose, even if you were on what you considered to be the right side. Mm-hmm. So being right isn't enough, and especially in a democracy where the job of someone who wants to gain elective office is to persuade enough people to come to the ballot box and vote for him or her, you have to learn to be persuasive.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one of the things that you're learning here. That's
It's interesting. I feel like I'm, of the things I've heard so far, they're falling into three categories. One is things I already knew that I maybe got to intuitively just from doing talk shows for 25, 30 years. Second are things I don't know yet that I'm really interested in working out to see if I do think they're true and I will keep. And then some things that I may not keep at all.
Yeah, yeah. It's remarkable. Richard just dropped by. Richard, you're not going to need the IFB. It's fine. You know, we're hitting a break here. Scott, stick around. We'll be right back. We're also going to check in with the news in about 4 minutes. And then at the top of the hour, in 20 minutes, I have a real special treat for you. The whole next hour is going to be with Dr. Richard Gannon. Stick around. We'll be right back. Yeah, the IFB.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with Scott Carter. Stick around. Talk to me about hypnosis. That's, you know, kind of at the core of what, you know, some of the stuff that you got excited about.
I'm very excited about it because I do believe in the subconscious and the power of the subconscious. And I haven't really, it's one of these things that has always interested me, or it's interested me for 2 or 3 decades. One of the reasons it interests me is because Charles Dickens was a mesmerist.
And Charles Dickens learned hypnotism from a protege of Mesmer's. And when he would do live performances, and he did over 300 live performances of readings from his works, and his original ambition had been to be an actor. And he got an audition at one of the leading theaters in London. And the day of the audition, he had a bad cold and did not show up. And so he became an author. But when he would do these live performances, he would keep the gas lights up in the auditorium because he wanted to be able to make eye contact with every person in the audience. And a lot of people thought that he kind of went into a trance, and a lot of people blame his early death on a reading that he did over and over. It was one of his favorites. Christmas Carol was the favorite, but the second favorite was the scene from Oliver Twist of Bill Sykes killing Nancy, strangling her. And he would do it with such aggression that even when his health was beginning to fail, he wouldn't pull back at all. And he would have to have doctors attending him after he got off stage, and they were measuring his pulse before the reading started and after the reading started. But he knew no other way but to go full force.
Yeah,
And so I've often thought of learning hypnosis as a way to get a better insight into Dickens.
I can tell you personally, when I speak, I put myself in a teaching trance, and one of my goals right away is to put my audience into a learning trance. Right. And
by day 9, I will have that skill that I do not have now. And you have talked about there, and Richard has written about there, 4 different stages of learning. And I feel like I'm in the second stage, which is, and do you want to explain what those 4 are?
Sure. You start out not knowing what you don't know. You're unconsciously incompetent. Then you figure out, hey, there's stuff I don't know. You become consciously incompetent.
That's where
you still don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Then you learn how to do it. It's like riding the bicycle, but you're still jiggling the wheels. So now you're consciously competent, but you're having to attend to it. And then when you're finally there, you're unconsciously competent. And like the way we drive a car, you can drive a car and talk to somebody at the same time. Back to you.
Right. So we'll see how long it takes me to get there. But I'm not there yet, but I'm in the place of openness. And if there's been maybe a primary lesson in my life over the last 20 or 30 years, it's been submitting myself to an uncomfortableness whereby I might learn something new and stop defending everything that I've been so certain of up until that moment. So I've done a lot of work with shamans. I've done different workshops for. We both have taken Robert McKee's story course. I've taken other courses. I now am very comfortable being uncomfortable.
That's a good thing.
I think it's the way you keep growing throughout your life, and I think it's maybe the way that we were designed to keep going. I never want to fossilize. I want to keep evolving.
There you go. Okay, we're hitting a break. Scott Carter, old friend of the show, executive producer of the Bill Maher Show.
First in studio guest in Portland.
Indeed, you were. Thanks so much for being with us, Scott.
Thank you, my pleasure.
We'll be back with Talk Media News. Luke Vargas is going to be with us, just bring us up to date on anything that's going on in the world. And stay tuned. At the top of the hour, a special treat. Dr. Richard Bandler will be with us. Luke Vargas is on the line with us. He is the New York-based international correspondent for Talk Media News. You can follow him on Twitter at The Courier. And this report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. Luke, welcome back to the program. What's at the top of the news today?
Well, I'm about to head to JFK Airport. I'm heading off to the Baltic and then to Helsinki for the big Putin summit next week. So obviously, I think attention is starting to shift now from the Supreme Court news last night. And President Trump's going to shift the agenda over to foreign policy for about a week. And his first stop on this international tour is to Brussels tomorrow. This is the closely watched NATO leaders summit where we can expect, by all indications, President Trump to really lay into countries that he believes are falling short in military contributions to the alliance. The big target, of course, which has probably been repeated 1,000 times, but I'll restate it, is a 2006 goal that was set by the European countries and NATO saying, look, we're going to spend 2% of GDP on our militaries. As of this morning, we have a new country that has hit that threshold, which is Latvia. But it joins a pretty small group of NATO members who have met their own targets. That includes, of course, the United States, Great Britain, Estonia, and Greece. We have a few more countries also on the Baltic front, Lithuania and Poland, just under 2%. But again, go ahead.
With regard to this, as you well know, when George Herbert Walker Bush negotiated the end of the Soviet Union with Mikhail Gorbachev, the explicit promise that he made to Gorbachev was that if Russia became an independent country, the former satellite states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, and Ukraine, would not become part of NATO and would not become militarized. That was the deal. And you just said that Estonia and Latvia both hit 2%, Donald Trump's goal for NATO spending. We know what's going on in Ukraine. And you said Poland is there. It seems to me that that's going to be high on Mr. Putin's list of things to discuss with Mr. Trump. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you can see where Putin's complaint there and Trump's complaint begin to overlap a little bit insofar as, hey, those European leaders are so wily, they break promises here and there. They're never really,
Well, it wasn't the European leaders. It was the Clinton administration.
Right. I think that's a dynamic to watch. I'm going to be embedding with the Latvian NATO contingent on Thursday and talking to their new commander, seeing their equipment. So that'll be really cool. And then we're going to do a segment on Friday. So I'll be very curious to share my impressions of how do the NATO battalions in those Baltic states describe their own activities, right? My hunch is, and that doesn't take a genius to predict this, that they'll put this all in terms of defense, right? This is for training purposes. It's about, making, the response to natural disasters or something like that. But it is impossible to deny that, the U.S. has been moving in equipment to that area, that increasingly NATO leaders talk about readiness, not in terms of some sort of hypothetical attack from anywhere, but hey, we need to be ready for a Russian ground invasion across the Estonia-Russia border. So how does that contingent describe its own behavior will be something very interesting to watch. And then, of course, we go to Great Britain. So after the one-day in Brussels, which probably going to be quite contentious. President Trump heads to the United Kingdom, where Theresa May is facing an extremely dire political crisis with her ruling Conservative Party essentially tearing itself into two pieces over the Brexit process. Basically, Theresa May is able to hang on to power after the elections last year because of a very small minority of votes coming from Northern Ireland. And it's the Irish border, this notion that if a hard Brexit, a very formal, concrete divorce from the European Union occurs, Ireland and Northern Ireland, an EU state and a British a piece of territory, would actually have a border erected along their frontier, which is in violation of the agreements ending the conflict in Ireland. So that has been splitting the party apart. She has sort of caved in, saying, look, we don't know exactly how we're going to handle the border, and thus we're going to have provisions in here which sort of make UK law a little bit more like European Union law. And that has infuriated people who want a hard break from Europe, and they don't like this idea that there
does
could
she,
be kind of a
does she do this by fiat, or is this subject to Parliament?
In this case, Parliament has sort of been trying to get as much power as possible to influence the Brexit agreement. But much like the president in the U.S. has that TPA authority, the Trade Promotion Authority, where the Congress is only able to give an up or down vote on a trade deal, the Parliament's sort of current abilities are much similar. They can't tweak this or do line item vetoes on parts of Brexit they don't want. They've just got to put their foot down in favor or against. And that, of course, doesn't leave Theresa May very much room to have a nuanced approach that caters to all parties. So you have the hardline Brexiters are almost causing the Conservative government to crumble, which is stoking the possibility of Jeremy Corbyn taking over the UK. It's turmoil in President Trump's words. I think he's spot on.
Yeah, which actually, in my opinion, would be a good outcome, but that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Luke Vargas with Talk Media News. Thanks a lot, Luke.
Thank you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Stick around. Thank you, Luke. Stick around. We'll be back with Dr. Bannon.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.